Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John. Today we'll be talking about the top five largest FinTech firms, what the CFPB is trying to do with FinTechs in regulation, a cashless society, is it really a dream or is it possible? And what Snapchat is up to in payments. With me today is Steve.
Hi, everyone.
And Monica.
Hello again.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to start us off with a trivia question. The United States was the second country to have deposit insurance after the Great Depression, after the stock market crash. What was the first country? Steve?
Is it the UK?
No.
Oh, good. Well, that was going to be my guess. Was it Canada?
It's so obvious.
Is it?
It's Czechoslovakia.
Oh,
that's right.
Course.
Czechoslovakia was the first country, followed by the US.
Proof that good ideas can happen anywhere.
And you know, there was only 12 countries that had deposit insurance as of 1974, and now there's over 100. So these things that you think have been around forever are really changing all the time, are new. And one thing we're going to do with this episode is have it be a non-blockchain cryptocurrency-focused episode. We'll get back to that next week. But we want to let you know that there's other stuff out there besides crypto and blockchain in the fintech world. A lot of great ideas, a lot of huge companies, and some interesting things going on out there. So that leads me right into our first story, which is the top five largest fintechs. And although and only one of them has something to do with cryptocurrency. So number five is Credit Karma, valued at $4 billion and founded in 2006, which is our geriatric startup fintech company for this episode. Credit Karma is interesting because they offer these free credit scores and financial management platforms, and they kind of... they expand into these kind of niche areas. Like I saw that they had this unclaimed money product.
Mm.
Have you seen
unclaimed
this?
Unclaimed money? No, what is this?
Yeah.
It's like where different states kind of hold money in escrow or in trust for different recipients, and then you can go back and claim your money.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's why you're here, Monica.
I've done that before, actually.
That sounds like a scam. Is that actually legal?
No, it's not, actually. So you might find that, you know, maybe you closed out a credit card 10 years ago, but you had like a $35 balance on it. That money is yours, and it's been handed over to the state, usually in which you were a resident at the time, and you can get your hands on it.
Cool.
Right. That's what Credit Karma does now. So very interesting. They do that in a few states now, and they're expanding, and they seem to be growing out into a lot of interesting areas like this. And that's earned them the number five spot and $4 billion private valuation. Number four is SoFi, valued at $4.5 billion and founded in 2011. So kind of around our median age for these private fintech firms. They have this alternative online lending platform, which takes into account things like your professional history, maybe like the LinkedIn kind of things.
The school you attended, right?
Your education.
Social finance,
it's social,
right?
Social finance, absolutely.
Exactly. So they've grown and passed other companies like LendingClub, and now they're growing out into other banking, traditional banking products like wealth management. They've expanded into, and they have SoFi Money, which we've mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
which still has a waiting list to join them.
Yeah.
So as we've seen, these companies expanding into other areas. Number three is a very interesting case, Robinhood, with a valuation estimated at $5.6 billion. And I say estimated because these are private companies, so we don't always have all the little details of their funding rounds and all the terms.
And in fact, we're often more likely to hear things that they would say about themselves, which might tend to be more favorable than what someone more critical on the outside might say.
Right. They're private, so they can accentuate the positive
mm-hmm.
if they want to. So just to take this with a grain of salt, Robinhood started in 2013, and they offer free trading for stocks, and they've added Bitcoin and Ethereum as of February 2018.
Interesting. I opened a Robinhood account a couple of years ago. I ended up closing it down because I just wasn't good at picking stocks. So
you and billions and of other billions, people.
Yeah, basically everyone
the trading,
else. Yeah.
The free trading doesn't mean that you're going to make money.
Exactly. I remember that I put in a couple dollars into Ryanair stocks or fractions of Ryanair stocks and lost a lot of it. So.
But don't worry. Robinhood probably made some money on the float
right.
from the, from
right.
the assets
right.
that you had in
yeah.
there. Because that's one of the things that that we were intrigued by as well. If the product is free, would a commodity service that is not usually expensive but often not free, how are they making their money? So I actually feel like Steve should talk about that more than me.
Yeah, so basically the way that they make money is that they take the money that you have in your account that's not invested and they float it or they get interest on that. And it sounds like it's small change, but if you spread that across, say, a million accounts or so, those 3 or 4 pennies can really add up on a daily basis. So that's how they are valued now at whatever $4.6
billion.
And they're
or also $5.6
billion. $5.6.
Yeah. And they're also doing something where they're loaning out the stock to short sellers. Is that right?
Correct.
So
yeah.
Broker-dealers do it's called rehypothecation, where they lend out their securities.
Ooh.
Fancy word.
That is
so,
a good
so
word.
So a lot of broker-dealers make their money this way. And
gonna have to put that in a password.
Yeah. Hey, don't rehypothecate that.
I'm not sure I can spell it.
Yeah. And they're also introducing a premium product, too. And the founder is an interesting character, too. Vlad Tenev has said that he wants to operate the business as for a break-even, not looking for a huge profit, apparently.
I wonder how his investors feel about that, about having him operate basically a break-even business.
Yeah. How about I give you millions of dollars, and at some indeterminate point in the future, you could just give me that exact same amount of money back?
Right. Sounds like a yeah. great deal for a VC.
Well, 10 times the money back. But
well, but a break-even philosophy.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg could have said the same thing for a long time while they lost money at Facebook. And he was just accumulating this huge database. And so I'm sure they'll find some way to monetize all of these users and transactions.
They always do.
So I'm not too worried about Robinhood. Number two on our list is Pay, and I think it's TM, PayTM, PayTime?
Paytm.
Paytm. I like that.
Paytm.
Maybe that's it. If you know, please let us know.
We are in ignorance here, so we are making up the pronunciation.
And this company is based in India, so we're not directly familiar with this one as much. They're valued at $7 billion, founded in 2010, and they're an e-commerce payment system and digital wallet company. So if you want to buy movie tickets, make travel reservations, anything like that, you use Paytm.
I think it's Paytm.
I prefer Paytm.
Like Paytm or PayATM, like ATM.
And so is their model somewhat non-reliant on people having credit, I would assume? Because India, I would imagine, is not a particularly high penetration of credit card holders. So they're probably using something that's less reliant. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who
yeah.
knows?
Yeah. We, On to our next one. So, yeah, there are large companies outside of the U.S. Like this this one in India. And there were some companies in China as well that we didn't include on the list just because they were associated with a large established company. So we weren't comfortable saying they're a private, independent fintech firm. The largest one for sure is Ant Financial, which is affiliated with Alibaba, the huge Chinese internet commerce company. And another one called Lu.com, which has over a $20 billion valuation.
Wow.
But was started by Angbang Insurance Group in Shanghai. So we didn't include them for that reason, that they're associated with a large company. So number one on our list is Stripe, valued at $9.2 billion.
So Stripe was founded by two young Irish brothers. You know, I think one of them might have been still a teenager when they started it. And Stripe has really been focused on helping developers basically site developers have a really kind of plug and play way to have online e-commerce, which you think right now in 2018, well, gosh, doesn't everybody have that? And that's no big deal. Anybody can set up a shop. But 9 years ago or so, it was a much harder proposition. So Stripe really saw an opportunity, and they focus on helping small, mid-size, any size business really just have a plug-and-play solution so they can start taking credit card charges and start shipping product.
Great, yeah. Yeah, Stripe has been very successful, and that's why they're valued over $9 billion now. So on to our next story. A cashless society, is it a con or is it a real deal, Steve?
So there's an interesting article that came out in The Guardian last week. So there's this person, Brett Scott, who used to be a former broker, I believe, in the UK, and he has an article in The Guardian entitled, Is Cashless Society a Big Con? And the gist of it is that basically we see this drive from banks to close branches, mm-hmm. sort of create more self-service via your phone and all that kind of stuff, and sort of have a more digital experience for all their services, which you all see. I think this is a fintech podcast, so we all see this as good for society, sort of a way to bring products more cheaply to market, more accessible, and so on and so forth. But Brett here argues that essentially this is the play for banks to save costs by having fewer number of employees staff their branches. And they also can, by having a society in which we all rely on digital products for payments or to move money around and so on and so forth, we are basically giving the bank access into our financial data. And if we were to use more cash, banks cannot really insert themselves in the payment there in the system. Mm-hmm. And by pushing us to be more digital, banks are they're doing two things. One, they can get some fees from that, from every transaction that we make. And two, they can also see that transaction data and use that to potentially sell us more stuff or basically just do better targeting for their customers. So
I think you sign your rights away to that data once you open an account or any type of financial service, right?
You absolutely do. It's also it's easy to trace the money around if it's not it could be on blockchain, it could be on a traditional system. But basically, by going through a bank's or some sort of fintech digital model, you cannot escape the market. You can't hide from the market. The argument has been for a while that if you have a purely cash-based society, it's sort of easier to do money laundering, to get bad guys to get access to money in the market, and so on and so forth. But
even if you take a few thousand dollars out of the bank, they can they report you, right?
They do, and it's also the same if you deposit money.
Is that for withdrawals or is that more around deposits?
Both. So there's two reports. There's the SAR, the mm-hmm. suspicious activity
report.
So that can be any amount, as long as you seem sketchy or they suspect something, even if it's $1,000 or below.
I thought the threshold was $10,000.
And the second report is the $10,000 threshold. So they're required to do a report for anything, a deposit or withdrawal cash transaction. Of $10,000 or more.
Oh, I forgot about withdrawals, but you're right because...
And if you try to layer it mm-hmm. by going to different bank branches, they're supposed to report that mm-hmm. as well. So if you deposit $5,000 in one branch and $5,000 in another, that still hits the threshold mm-hmm. if it's the same
day. They probably do that in the U.S. through there's a consortium called Early Warning Systems that basically shares bank information across all the major banks in the U.S. and some smaller ones as well. And I think that they basically use that to kind of, as the name implies, to provide early warning for any kind of fraud stuff. So that mm-hmm. if you're depositing, right. as you say, money to one account here or money to one bank here, money to the other bank, then they can still see that. So
yeah, and it might be legitimate, but they check. You're suspicious for using cash.
Right.
That's
exactly, yeah.
And we're definitely a different world from where that was the norm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you believe Brett and the article that he published in The Guardian, stop using online stuff. Stop using your phone to pay for stuff. Just use more cash.
Well, I do think there's one point that Brett doesn't hit particularly hard, but he does make mention of that, the push to digital services can leave the underbanked and, say, under-interneted behind. So it is something to think about in terms of...
The elderly... immigrant communities, absolutely.
Exactly.
People who are marginalized, yeah.
So it's something to think about in terms of the financial system's inclusion.
Yeah, it's also the matter of, I think a few weeks ago there was a visa outage in the UK, where you can use Visa or in any Visa card. So, you know, unlike any of the payment rails, cash doesn't go down. So it's easy to make your payments even if the system's down.
This article did make me think, living in earthquake country, that I probably need to tuck away some small bits or maybe big bits of cash in the old apartment.
A duffel bag full of cash.
No, not a duffel bag, but, you know, maybe just like
a wallet.
A few $100 bills.
Yeah.
A USB stick with half a Bitcoin.
Right.
Just in case.
When the big one hits, I'm sure that'll go far.
Exactly.
Well, great. Yeah, that's definitely an interesting article. And now for our next article, Snapchat is looking to get away from online payments.
Right, so another kind of interesting story. Snapchat just pulled out of the P2P payment space. So as we all know, there's things like Zelle, which big banks produce. There's Venmo, there's PayPal. There's a lot of ways to get money around. There's Apple Pay. Essentially, Snapchat announced just this week they're no longer going to provide their Snap Cash product via Snapchat, via their app. So we saw that they basically could never take enough market share from Venmo and PayPal and the incumbent players. So they just said, we're going to cede the space to Venmo and PayPal. You guys do it. And it's interesting to know that I saw a few months ago there was a report about Venmo and the fact that they lose money on every transaction. So even though they're super popular now, for every time that you pay your roommate for whatever rent or like beers, whatever, they end up losing money on that fee. So it's still not a profitable model per se. Mm. And I've also heard that the...
So every time you use Venmo, a VC cries a tear.
Well, they're owned by PayPal, so it's a public company.
Oh,
so I guess a shareholder sheds a tear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's also, I believe that also the rate at which they're losing money is also accelerating, which is interesting.
Well, they're succeeding. People are using them more, I guess.
Exactly. It's like grow first.
And they might be using them for really low-value transactions, right?
Right.
So if they have a fairly fixed transaction cost, somebody transferring $5 for a piece of pizza, it's not really... not really a moneymaker.
It's not a moneymaker, yeah. I don't
yet.
Ever transfer
the Webvan of payments.
Right. The pets.com of payments.
Pets.com. Yeah, order a Snickers bar and Webvan, and you have no idea how they make money. And you know what? They weren't.
And they weren't, yeah.
back to the Snapchat news here, though. I did think it was interesting that one of the things in the articles mentions that Snapcash was seen as a really useful place for people who might want to sell nude or racy shots.
Yeah.
And that Snapchat had that to consider as well. Is that really the business that we want to be in if we have a small part of this market and it's kind of seen as seedy?
That's right. I mean, they came up and the whole argument against Snapchat was that they were basically the disappearing selfie app, right? Just like naked selfies for teens. So they want to move away from that market and that perception, at least.
Well, yeah, if you've paid $10 for a nude pic, you don't want it to disappear.
That's right. Screenshot it.
And now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it. I'll start with 2019. That's the year when the FinTech Consortium will open its North American flagship location in...
sunny San Francisco?
Nope. Not New York, Chicago.
Sunnyvale.
Detroit.
Shanghai. Oh!
Detroit! Look at
the
that.
Center of finance these days in Detroit.
Of course.
No, they've named it as a place with a lot of innovation and flexibility and maybe reasonable real estate costs.
Maybe.
May have played into that, but they didn't play that up as much.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, Detroit has been seeing a lot of... investment, which we're all happy to see.
Exactly. It thrills my heart to see every time Detroit is having another brick in its urban renewal.
That's right.
Love it.
So the other world headquarters of the other flagship locations, I should say, for the FinTech Consortium are in Bahrain and Singapore. So one of these places is not like the other, for sure. But what the FinTech Consortium does is it promotes fintechs. It offers co-working spaces, opportunity for networking, investments, and that sort of thing. So we're happy to see that going on in Detroit in 2019. So they're They're doing construction now. So next for our final bite, Steve.
Sure. So my number is $150 bazillion. No, it's $150 billion.
Billion?
$1 billion.
You mean million, Steve?
No, I mean million. So $150 billion.
1,000 millions.
1,000 million. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Or 1,000,000,000. Yes, 1,000 million.
150,000 million. Yeah.
All right. Oh, wow. Well, that's my number. That's a lot of zeros. Sorry, I'm not very.
It is a lot of zeros.
Yeah. So that is a number, that is a valuation for Ant Financial, which used to be called Alipay, which, as we know, is that big fintech company in China, which it wasn't in our top five funded fintech company list. But if we were to include Chinese companies, this one would be by far the most valued, the most highly valued company.
And Ant Financial is mainly playing in the Asian space right now?
I think it's almost exclusively China and neighboring countries.
Okay.
But I know they're looking to expand to the US and Europe as well, especially as more Chinese tourists travel to the West, to the US and Europe, essentially, so they can use also Alipay to pay for stuff.
And Chinese tourism, I know that's not the topic of our podcast, but Chinese tourism is an incredibly fast-growing piece of the global tourism economy.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Anyway, that's my number.
And I will go with a number that does not have quite as many zeros, but still, enough zeros for me. And enough zeros for the person who will be referencing. My final bite is $28.3 million. And that is the pre-tax take-home pay of one Mr. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase. So as I always say, banking is a great gig. So Jamie had a good year, and we'll see where he ends up at the end of this year, I'm guessing somewhere in the same neighborhood.
Yep, and he's just ahead of the FinTech Newscast revenues.
Just a bit ahead. So I used to work for the listeners here, I used to work at JP Morgan Chase, and I remember when there were a few key departures from the bank that went from the investment bank to private equity and sort of the buy side as well, because the people who left so that they could make more money, leaving the C-suite of JP Morgan to go join a PE firm. So I'm assuming there'll be like another zero on top of that. So instead of like a $20 million salary, you'd get maybe $40 or $50 million. Mm-hmm. So it all kind of sounds like silly money, but that's the level of salaries that we're discussing here.
Mm. Good work if you can get it.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. We'll provide the links to the articles in our show notes. And thanks for listening.
Bye for now.
Talk to you next week.